welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. That's me, and I'm so glad you're here. If you like what we do, I'd love it if you gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you're so compelled, write a review. That really helps. And maybe tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. If you want to get involved in the program, visit our website, talkingbeats.com, and click Support the Show, where you can make either a one-time or a recurring donation. As we look to continue having cliche-free conversations of real substance with a diverse range of the world's most compelling people, your support is so appreciated, especially as we look to expand and increase our offerings. If you have a question, comment, or thought, find us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or if you wish to reach out directly, email me at daniel@talkingbeats.com. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get on with today's conversation. On today's program, we're speaking with physician Dr. Lina Wen. She's public health professor at George Washington University and non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's also a contributing columnist for the Washington Post and a CNN medical analyst. Previously, she served as health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. She's here with her new book in hand called Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey into the Fight for Public Health, described as an insider's account of public health and its crucial role, from opioid addiction to global pandemic, and inspiring story of her journey from struggling immigrant to being one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. Dr. Lina Wen, friend of this program, joins me now, and I'm thrilled to have her. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join you again.
Before we delve into some of your personal details, because I'm holding this beautiful book here, Lifelines, it's a great title, memoir, Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Can you give a definition of public health? What is it to you?
It's a great question. And I actually think it's helpful to, in a way, to talk about what public health is not. A lot of people think about public health as the opposite of private health. I mean, that's not it. It's not just about health care. And in fact, that is core to the definition of public health, that it's not just about the care that you receive in the hospital when you're ill that determines how well and how long you live. It's actually so many other aspects of people's lives, including the air that they breathe, the water that they drink, the food that they have access to, the environment in which they live, that could also determine whether they are healthy or unhealthy. I was the former health commissioner of Baltimore, as you mentioned, and in my city, there are children born today who can expect to live 65 years or 85 years, depending on the zip code of their birth. That also is about public health as well. One of the aspects, and actually what drove me to write Lifelines, is this idea that public health saved your life today, you just don't know it. That public health, by definition, doesn't have a face. But because it often works when it's invisible, because we have literally prevented something from happening, it often becomes the first thing on the chopping block as well when it comes to budget time. And so putting the face on public health is really critical.
Why would public health go to the chopping block? Isn't it sort of a basic thing that you want the people around you to be relatively healthy? It seems to me sort of logical, but I guess politics always don't work by the rules of logic. But what do you say? You interacted with a lot of politicians, and you speak of certain politicians that certainly mentored you, Senator Mikulski and people like that. But when you sit down, or in your past life, when you were sitting down on a regular basis with politicians, you had to say, wait a minute, this is important. Don't you want your kids to sort of get in a good meal instead of chicken nuggets from McDonald's? I mean, basic things, clean water. That's first world country.
Well, prior to the pandemic, no one really thought about public health. And that was the issue. It was always challenging to make the case for the work that we do, because by definition, public health has succeeded when we prevent something from happening. So there is the face of a child who was lead poisoned. But what about all the home remediation that we did to prevent that from occurring in the first place? Or there is the person, there's the face of a person who was poisoned in a restaurant because of unsanitary conditions. But what about the thousands of restaurant inspections that we did to prevent that from happening in the first place? Prior to the pandemic, there was, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a politician who ran for office on a platform of public health. I mean, that's just not what people think about. You have to make the case for that person as to why whatever they care about, whether it's education or criminal justice or the economy, has a direct tie to public health. But it's not something that people intuitively think about. And yet, health is essential to all other aspects. I mean, talking about criminal justice, there is a direct link between that and our policies of mass incarceration to put people in jail for the disease of addiction instead of treating them for it, or mental health issues and homelessness. Instead of treating individuals and providing services, we have, this has led to public safety issues. And if we don't have healthy workers, we can't have a productive economy. I mean, public health directly ties to all these other issues that people care about, but we have to make the case for them. And if not, because there is no face of the thing that we're literally trying to do, no one is an advocate for it. There's no advocate for something that didn't happen. And that's why the work of public health is so critical, but also why we have actually seen what occurred during the time of COVID, when public health becomes underfunded, disinvested, and undervalued.
We'll get to COVID a little later. Obviously, there's so much to talk about because it's certainly not as much in the rearview mirror as I think a lot of people thought. Here we are speaking at beginning of August, and certainly maybe a month or 6 weeks ago, people thought, whoa, it's kind of receding. But okay, we can talk about that a little later. But first, I just want to say that the book opens in Shanghai, where you were born, amazing city. I've performed there. I've eaten some of the best food of my life there. It's a great food town. People who know this podcast know I'm very passionate about food, and Shanghai is a great food town. And here you are in a one-room apartment, very close with your paternal grandparents, Nai Nai and Ye Ye. And you are talking about early lessons. In fact, the first chapter is wonderful, Chi Ku. In Mandarin, it means to eat bitter. I'm quoting here, to sacrifice and go through great hardships. My grandparents always added a second part, that one eats bitter in order to taste sweet. Why do you want to open the book like this in reverence to your grandparents who clearly taught you so much, taught you so many values and dreamed of betterment?
You know, Daniel, I actually had not intended to write about my personal story in this book. My initial intention was to share the stories from Baltimore, the stories of successes in public health, again, to uplift this field that people don't really understand. But actually, in talking to my publisher convinced me to write about my own story, because in a lot of ways, my own story is a story of public health as well. And I hoped that by sharing the hardships that my family and I went through earlier in life, that in a way, it also definitely demonstrates why I'm passionate about medicine and public health, but also it demonstrates why for so many people, public health is our lifeline. And so I opened the book by talking about my childhood. This idea of sacrifice was very much embedded in me as a child, not just in China, but especially when my parents and I immigrated to the US just before I turned 8. And they worked multiple jobs, and yet still, we had a lot of difficulty making ends meet. At times, we experienced homelessness. We were dependent on various social services from the government, including food stamps. And I went to public school through college, I attended a public university. And so I say all of this because I saw early on in my childhood what happens when people go without access to healthcare. I saw what happened in my childhood when a boy literally died in front of me because he didn't have access to care. And in a sense, I also saw how people's lives are valued differently depending on who they are. And depending on what social economic circumstances they are born into. And I think that very much spurred me to do this work in public health that I think is about leveling the playing field of inequality.
I very much like this early conversation that you recount with your grandparents. And in fact, it's when your mother has gone to America to graduate school and you're confused. You don't know why, and you're unhappy and you're sad. And the conversation goes like this. Your grandmother says to you, "Do you know why your mother's in America? She doesn't know one person there. It's frightening for her. But she's doing it because she wants you to have a better life."
Right.
This is the American dream. It's alive and well. And here you are.
Well, here I am, although here my mother is not. And I have talked about this in the past, and so I don't think this is giving too much away in the book. But my my mother and I had a fraught relationship growing up. I knew intellectually that she was sacrificing so much for me and for my little sister, but I also just didn't see her. I mean, she was working all the time. And she was also very strict, and we fought a lot over a lot of things that I think maybe parents and their teenage kids fight over. And we were actually quite estranged until she ended up getting diagnosed with cancer when I was a medical student. And she passed away about 10 years ago now. I think about my mother a lot. And I think about her a lot now, especially as I have two little kids of my own who never had the chance to meet their grandmother. And I talk about this in this context, and your question really spurred my reflection on this, because there is so much that I now so deeply appreciate about my mother. I so deeply appreciate, of course, the sacrifices that she made in order to give a better life for me and my sister. But there's so many characteristics in my mother that I look at now and I think, oh my goodness. I mean, I hope that I've inherited some of these. I mean, her ethics of hard work, how she cared so much about other people, she always told us about giving and service, that no matter how little we might have at any point in time, she always said that there were other people who had even less. And so it was our obligation to give to others. She was so grateful to the U.S., to our adopted country. She always, always believed in serving our country in any way that we could. And so, I mean, I think about that so much now because I miss my mother, and also because I didn't have a chance to tell her when she was alive about how much what the lessons that she imparted on me and the person that she was, how much that left an imprint on me. And I wish every day that my children will be able to at least get to know a little bit of their grandmother. And that was also part of the reason why I wanted to write about her in my book.
Indeed, there's a very powerful saying in here in the chapter called Belonging. And the saying is, I'll let you expound on it and translate, Bai Xing Xiao Wei Xian. What is this?
It is about filial piety.
I mean, and excuse my pronunciation, by the way, but I'm glad you knew what I was talking about.
Right. I mean, I included this because there were times when I was a child, and I was a bit of a bratty child, but now I have an almost 4-year-old who's also kind of a bratty child. So maybe he got that from me, or maybe it's just being little kids. My almost 4-year-old, by the way, has recently taken to throwing everything into the toilet and then flushing it and then laughing uproariously so that we don't quite know what's landed in the toilet. We believe that there are car keys in there as the most recent thing that he's thrown down. But
he should be practicing the piano instead.
Right. That would be a much better use of his what we call his Eli energy.
And more melodious, perhaps, than keys going into a toilet. Okay.
Right. And actually less costly because we had to replace these keys, but nevertheless. I was this kind of bratty child, and, I complained about things. I was complaining about why we had to move to the U.S. and why we were going through all these sacrifices, and why at the time that we initially came, we moved to a little town in the mountains of Utah where it was really cold and we didn't have heating. And I thought, oh my, you know, we're wearing all these, we wore all these layers of clothes. I was showing up to school wearing 6 sweaters and 5 pairs of pants. And of course, people were looking at me, and I didn't know English, so I'm sure they were looking for other reasons because I was the only non-white kid in the school. But I was so embarrassed of who I am and my parents and just everything. I mean, I was very angry. And my grandparents, my grandmother in particular, would say to me, look, your parents are giving up so much. I don't think you quite appreciate how much they are sacrificing for you, but it's also your duty to sacrifice for them too. Here's how much they're doing for you. You need to be doing this for them. And again, that's something that I don't think I quite understood at the time. But especially as I was writing this book, I mean, all these details that I had forgotten as a child, either intentionally or not, they ended up flooding back. My mother actually had a terrific memory. She didn't keep a diary, or else I wish that I would have been able to consult her or her notes. But so many things came back, and I ended up writing about many of these parts of my life that actually were really difficult to think about, much less put on paper. And I'm actually very nervous about what people are going to think when they read the book, because somebody had said to me, oh, this is not a typical politician's memoir. I am not a politician. So I said, well, that's probably why it's not a typical politician memoir. But I think they meant it in the way that I was very open about the challenges that I faced and about the shame and fear that I faced at different parts of my life. And I have shared some of these stories in bits and pieces before, but to put it all in one place in this book, I'm very nervous and anxious about what people will think once they read the book. And I hope they'll see the intention of why I put the stories there, because I thought if I face this degree of fear, shame, and stigma around my own aspects of my own life, then I am certain that others face it too, with maybe different parts of their life, but that in sharing our stories, we can overcome these vulnerabilities and ideally turn them from sources of shame into our strength.
Well, I so appreciate it. And I think having the background and the personal family history, the good, bad, and the ugly, the rich, the poor, makes the book so much more, frankly, interesting than it would have been. It adds so many layers. It adds layers of person that wouldn't be there had it been a sort of a purely medical or a public health treatise, which parts of it are, but many parts aren't. So it's wonderful in that respect, I think. Dr. Lena Nguyen, when you talk about public health and you look at other paths one can take, surely there must be easier, more glamorous paths than becoming health commissioner of a troubled city. Why did you want that challenge?
Being the health commissioner for the city of Baltimore was my dream job. I mean, going back to my childhood, I had always wanted to be a doctor. I was one of those annoying people who, when people ask me now, how old were you when you wanted to be a doctor? Or was it something that you came to later in life? Actually, I'd wanted to be a doctor for as long as I could remember. Although initially, I was really afraid to admit to people that I wanted to be a doctor because I thought that they wouldn't believe me. I mean, when I first entered college, as an example, I mean, I didn't have mentors who were doctors. I didn't shadow a physician. I mean, I just knew early on that I wanted to make a difference in people's lives. I saw what happened when people went without access to care. I wanted to provide care for the most vulnerable who otherwise would not be able to receive it. I mean, that was my clear North Star, but I also didn't know literally how to do it. And I remember that early on in college when people said, what do you want to be when you graduate? I would say, I want to be a lab tech. Because I thought it was believable. My parents had a friend whose daughter was a lab tech. That was a path that I thought I could do. You know, I was good at science and math. I thought I could work in a lab and then graduate and be a lab tech. But I was very fortunate to have mentors who encouraged me all along, who got it out of me eventually that I wanted to be a physician, and then helped me to connect with their other former mentees who then taught me about getting good MCAT scores and shadowing physicians and getting community service and other things, these unwritten rules that I wouldn't have had otherwise. But in any case, that's why I was drawn to medicine. But it was also working in the ER that I saw how much it's not just medical care that determines the course of people's lives. It's also public health. And I felt actually so burnt out working in the ER because there were so many things that I thought my patients really needed, but I couldn't provide it for them in the ER. As in, I remember talking about this child I had, a patient of mine who came in all the time because of asthma, but he didn't just need new medications.
Which you had as a kid, by the way.
That's exactly right. And so I understood this ailment very well. It's also the bread and butter of pediatric emergency medicine. But I knew that what this child needed, though, was actually housing, because he and his mother were experiencing homelessness. They were in and out of shelters where everybody around them smoked. But what was I going to do in the ER to help him with housing? It just felt so hopeless, in a sense, to be giving inhalers and nebulizers, knowing that he would be back because of the other circumstances in his life. And so, directly to your question, when I had the opportunity to apply to become the health commissioner for Baltimore and become the doctor for my city and start actually working on these social determinants of health, these social issues, these healthcare, these health issues that directly impact people's well-being, that's not just about healthcare, I thought this is what I would love to do. And it's still, to this day, I think it's still my dream job because of how much we were able to do and how much that job had a direct impact on people's lives.
Well, no one would think that being the top doctor for a major city would be easy. Obviously, every city's complex and has its own set of challenges. What shocked or surprised you when you came on the job? You probably weren't wearing rose-colored glasses at the time. I don't think you expected a perfect scene out of a storybook, but what shocked you when you took the job?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question about what shocked me. I'll tell you that there were a lot of pleasant, maybe not surprises, but just I had known that there were a lot of great people already working in Baltimore. Our health department is the oldest continuously operating health department in the country, founded in 1793. And so there was a long history also of health commissioners who were bold and innovative. We were on the forefront, for example, of setting up needle exchanges more than 20 years ago and had done a lot of other programs that might have been difficult to get off the ground in other places. So I was very excited about taking on this role with so many great people working in the city, with a wonderful mayor, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake at the time, and with many community partners who were really dedicated to improving health. I'll tell you what there was one instance that I would say was shocking and dismaying right as I was starting. So I had known that one of my priorities would be working on the opioid epidemic. My mayor had a saying that if everything's a priority, nothing is a priority. And I had picked three priorities: maternal and child health, care for the most vulnerable, and addressing opioid overdose deaths and treating addiction. So I knew that this was already going to be one of the main areas. And I remember that I was still finishing up my job at GW, and I was teaching a group of medical students that morning. And I had asked this group of medical students, we happened to be talking about the issue of overdoses. So I was asking them, what does it look like when you encounter somebody who has an overdose? And they gave very technical, correct, but technical answers at like pinpoint pupils or depressed respirations. And I thought, you know, so I just had that incident, that instance. Then I went to a community meeting where there were a lot of young people in attendance. And I actually wasn't even sure that I wanted to talk about overdose. But then I thought, okay, this is one of my priorities. I should mention it. So then I asked the same question to this group. And I said, what does it look like when somebody is dying from an overdose? There were all these young people. And by young, I'm talking about 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds who raised their hands and it described to me what it looked like when somebody was dying from an overdose. They talked about their mother who had passed down on the couch and they were unable to wake them. They talked about an uncle that they tried to pour water on their head or put ice packs in their groin because they were taught in their family that that's what they had to do to try to save somebody who was overdosing. I mean, it was really heartbreaking to hear these 8, 9, 10-year-olds talk about how no one in their family gets up in the morning. They're the only ones who get up and go to school and they help their 6-year-old sibling go to school because everybody else is addicted to heroin and other drugs. I mean, I think that, not that I was surprised necessarily, because of course I understood that addiction tied into every aspect of our city, but hearing how much it intimately affected people's lives, including these young children's lives, it was dismaying, but it also very much was key to compelling action at that point.
There's a great part in the book where you're talking about some of the political mentors that you had, and the mayor of Baltimore, Senator Barbara Mikulski, as well as Elijah Cummings, the congressman. Talk about how political people influenced you in maybe non-political ways. What kind of things did these leaders of your area in the country, did these figures impart on you? What kind of lessons that go beyond what we would know from reading their policy or seeing them conduct themselves at a hearing? What kind of mentorship?
Well, from each of the three individuals that you mentioned, I learned a great deal. Congressman Elijah Cummings was my longtime mentor. He has, as you and your listeners know, has since passed away. But I mean, there's so much with Congressman Cummings. I mean, he used to say, and I cited this in the book, about pain, passion, and purpose, that you channel your pain into your passion that is your purpose. And for me, that rang so true. And I think for so many people in Baltimore, it ran so true because there was so much in my life, in our lives, that was deeply painful. But that also is the reason for why we do the work that we do and spurs us on every day. And I think about this a lot. I mean, even with my mother's passing and her diagnosis with cancer, I mean, that was such a horrible experience for us as a family. That's still deeply painful for me to talk about now. But because of her misdiagnosis and the lessons that we learned in the course of her illness, that's what spurred my passion for patient advocacy and my purpose in doing the work of bridging that disconnect between what patients need and what the healthcare system is providing. Congressman Cummings also, I went with him to many community meetings. And I talk about this in Lifelines too, about how he would, anytime he would encounter someone, whether it was someone new or someone he's known for a long time, he would make them feel like they are the only person in the world. No matter how many other people were trying to get his attention, no matter what else was going around him, he would look at them and make them realize that they were heard, that they were seen, and that they mattered. And I hope that with my patients, with people that I meet, that I'm able to give them that same undivided attention to show them how much they matter to me. And I would just add too, with Senator Barbara Mikulski, who I also highlight as another one of my mentors. I talked previously about Mayor Rawlings Blake already, and if everything's a priority, nothing is a priority. But with Senator Barbara Mikulski, she taught me a lot too. She taught me, she often liked to use this quote that you should do what you're best at and what you're needed for. And actually, I thought about this a lot, even in the time of COVID, because since February of 2020, I've pivoted all my work to COVID very intentionally. This is the biggest public health crisis of our time. And I thought with my public health background and as an emergency physician, as a researcher, as a communicator for public health, that this is what I need to focus on. But I think back to what Barbara Mikulski says a lot in this sense, do what you're best at and what you're needed for, because it's not so much for me about this dream aspiration that I'm trying to achieve, but rather, what is it, where is it that I can best serve right now?
And I'm going to use that as a nice segue, what you're best at, what you're needed for. It's such practical advice, but a lot of the pandemic, people have been going to music as a source of, not consolation, sometimes consolation, but also stability, emotional stability, and as sort of a place to hang their hat. Because music is the great unifier, and it is the thing that resonates, whether it's Chicago or Shanghai, the same way, in a sense. You play Beethoven 9, and people are moved in the same way. Different ways, but in the same way. And music is a type of medicine, in my opinion. It might not be a cure for the things that you deal with, but I believe it's an emotional medicine and a stimulus that we need, not could use, but I think we need it. What role does music play in your life? Am I crazy for saying we need it? I need it like I need air and water every day. And many people do. And I think many people could benefit from music if music doesn't play a big role in their lives. But certainly for the hardest year for many people that they've ever gone through, music has been the thing that stabilized them and comforted them.
I so agree with you. I think that music is something that for many people grounds them and centers them. And I love what you said about music being the great unifier, because in our world today, and this is definitely not meant to be a political statement, it just is a description of the world, that we are so polarized as a country. We're so polarized as a world. And yet there is common ground, or as Elijah Cummings would say, higher ground. And I think that music has an essential role to play in that. I actually talk about music a little bit in Lifelines. I didn't get into too much detail here, but music was something that was very important, has always been very important in my life. I started playing the piano when I was 3. I also, in school, because I was going in between different schools so much, I didn't have a lot of friends and didn't have groups that I really belonged to. But I learned to play the violin so that I could play in the school orchestra. I learned to play the flute and clarinet because I also thought, you know, I want to be able to be useful. And so if there is a need for someone to step in, because a lot of people play the violin and piano, not a lot of people play wind instruments. And so, but music continues to play. And actually later on in graduate school, I tried my hand in chamber music. And still music is an important part of my life as someone who enjoys it very much. So I mentioned that I have 2 little kids, including a 1-year-old, the baby that was born during the pandemic. She's now 15 months old. But I felt very alone when I first gave birth. My family, my husband's family, they're in different parts of the world. My father is in Vancouver. I live in Baltimore. My mother-in-law, my husband's mother, lives in Johannesburg in South Africa. For a variety of reasons related to travel restrictions and COVID, neither of them have even been to visit us to meet the baby, who again is 15 months old. We also haven't had the benefit of friends come by as much as they would have in other ways. And I mean, again, I'm not complaining. It's just, you know, it's just the reality that already, I think for a lot of new moms, that can be a challenging time of vulnerability and a lot of loneliness, but particularly so during the pandemic. And so I have turned to music once more in my life. My baby, as it turns out, loves music, which I don't think is coincidental. I think it's because I played a lot of music when she was a newborn. And so,
Good for you.
Thank you. But she loves Bach. She loves Mozart. She actually sings some songs, which I realize I'm not trying to make it sound like she's a prodigy, but it's more that we play music all the time. And so she knows Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. She knows Happy Birthday. She sings all these. She knows the ABCs, kind of. I mean, she hums along. But she's doing that, I think, because music has been such an integral part of her early life as a result of the pandemic.
That is wonderful. And I certainly think that as soon as she's old enough to get up on the piano bench or get up on a little piano bench, lessons, there's all sorts of people who come on here. And it's amazing to me how many people don't think about how much they love music until it comes up. And they say, you know what, you're right. It's actually been there for me when I needed it most. And certainly it provides a level of companionship. There was a wonderful conductor who I used to work with a lot. He's retired now. He's much older. And he said that music will be your best friend in life. It'll never let you down, ever. Mm. It'll always be there for you when you think everything's crumbling. And I think so many people have felt that this year. And certainly in dark times for me, we all have dark times here and there. And there is a Schubert trio waiting for us. He died when he was 31. And we listened to the slow movement. And we can't believe what he accomplished and what was in him before he died at age 31.
Wow. I mean, that's so profound about music always being there for us. And I mean, people have different things that center them. But as you said, I mean, I am frequently surprised too by how many people I talk to who I've known them for many years. And on a professional level, we bonded over a lot of things. But I didn't know the impact that music has had in their lives. Both of my children actually have been going to Music Together classes. There's a great Music Together course in our area with a wonderful instructor named Miriam. Both of them have been going since they were babies. And I hope that the love for music is something that they will continue to have through their lives too.
Last note on Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, by the way. For people who are listening who think it's just a silly little song, go on the internet and type in Mozart Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. You'll be shocked. He wrote, when he was 25 years old, a set of variations, 12 variations on this theme. And it is absolutely a wonderful piece. So I hope everybody will go and listen to that, because you're going to be shocked at what he does with it. Mozart was one of the great writers of variation in all of music.
I look forward to looking that up, and I am certain that my baby, the one-year-old, will love it as well. Maybe she'll learn to play it one day, hopefully one day soon.
Dr. Lena Wen, here we are midway through, it's amazing to say, but midway through 2021. COVID has the number 19 attached to it. That's a long time ago. 2019 was a long time ago. What is happening now? How much... I think people are thinking to themselves, how much longer? Is it going to be a lot longer?
Well, I think if it's anything that we've learned during COVID, it's that if somebody tries to make a prediction, maybe don't believe them, because this virus has taught us to be really humble. This entire pandemic has taken many twists and turns, some of which were predictable because of human behavior, some of which were not predictable. The Delta variant that's now overtaken us here in the US and in some other parts of the world, for example, was not necessarily something that we could have foreseen. And there are other variants that may well arise that may be of even greater concern. You know, I'm really worried at the time that we're speaking. I'm very worried about where we are as a country. And I've been reflecting a lot on this concept of American exceptionalism, that here we are in the US sitting on a huge surplus of doses of vaccine. We're trying to convince people, as we should here in the US, to get the vaccine. We're doing everything we can to beg them and bribe them even to take the vaccine, to mandate it, and to try to get them to do the right thing to protect one another, including our unvaccinated younger children and immunocompromised family members. And then here are other people around the world, including healthcare workers and vulnerable elderly people who have yet to see a drop of the vaccine and who are probably going to die. I mean, there are people dying right now around the world who could be alive today if they had access to the vaccine, and they would have taken it. They wouldn't have hesitated to take it. And so I've been reflecting a lot on the role that America has in this time. And to your question about where we're going, someone said the other day that something that I thought was quite profound about the virus and the vaccine, which is that if we don't share the vaccine, the virus will share the world. And if we don't share the vaccine, the virus will share the world. And that is what's happening right now. So how long is this going to go on for? I don't know, but I am very concerned that we have not seen the end of this by a long shot.
What about all the people who say it's over, it's done with? What do you say?
They're wrong. I mean, look at the ICUs that are filling up again in many parts of the country, that are filling up again, by the way, with young people. The dynamics of the pandemic have shifted. Older individuals tend to have gotten vaccinated first, which is good. They are more likely to die from COVID. So I'm glad that they're vaccinated and are protected. But that also means that younger individuals who did not get vaccinated by choice, who thought that they were somehow invincible, they are the ones who are getting very sick. They're being put on ventilators. Some of them are dying and leaving behind young children who could now be orphaned because of COVID. I mean, this is what's happening right now. And I think for anyone who believes that somehow we have reached herd immunity, for anyone who believes that somehow this pandemic is over, I hope they don't find out the hard way that it has not, because so many families around the country are finding that out every day.
It's difficult to imagine here right now. I'm speaking to you from Hanover, New Hampshire, the home of Dartmouth College, and this area I think has more than 80% vaccination, maybe close to 90 by now, right across the river from Vermont, which is the leading state. And I don't know a single person here who isn't vaccinated. It's sort of, I hate to use the word normal, but it feels quite calm here and quite safe, frankly. But I look across the country, look at certain counties in Missouri and Arkansas, the state of Alabama, which is around 34-35%, the last in the country. It is amazing to see geographic differences. In the Upper Valley in New Hampshire and Vermont, things are quite rosy. 1,000 miles away, pretty terrible.
That's right. I mean, we do have quite a variation across our country. There are parts of the country, not surprisingly, by the way, at this point, that have low vaccination rates. There were also the places that did not believe in masking. Many of these places never really had mask restrictions either. They now have a high rate of coronavirus infection. Of course, what will contain the infection is masking and vaccination. But these are the same places that have resisted these two elements and unfortunately have really politicized these elements. I really worry because now we have a situation where the problems among the unvaccinated individuals as well as unvaccinated areas, they are spilling over into everybody else. I mean, I think there has been this rather unhelpful narrative that's come from the CDC. And you know what? I have criticized when criticism was necessary, the Trump administration, the same with the Biden administration too. The Biden administration has done many things right with the pandemic, but it made a grave error with its premature return to normalcy. They also made a grave error in a message that sounds like, if you're vaccinated, that's your choice. So then people would say, well, why do you care if others are vaccinated too? And it's because if you're vaccinated, you are well protected from becoming severely ill. The problem, though, is you could still contract coronavirus through these breakthrough infections if you're fully vaccinated. And here's the reason why. I have equated the vaccine to a very good raincoat. So if you have a great raincoat and you're in a drizzle, you'll be fine. If you're in multiple drizzles, you'll probably also be okay. But what if you keep on going in and out of thunderstorms and hurricanes? I mean, at some point, you're going to get wet. And that's what's happening, that when there is a lot of virus around us, even if we are fully vaccinated and protected, if we are going, for example, into a crowded conference room or crowded concert venues where a whole lot of people around us are unvaccinated and potentially infected, we could get sick even if we are vaccinated. And so that, I think, is the concern that, yes, there are parts of the country that are doing really well, but it may not stay that way because the virus does not know borders.
The politicization is so troubling. Certain things should be immune, to use a germane adjective, from politics. Medicine, I think a lot of music should be separate, and certain other fields should exist above all that, separate from all that. But I guess we're at a point where politics makes its way into everything, and probably to our detriment. But certainly do appreciate your candor about criticizing multiple administrations when there's a medical need. What would you tell older people who are vaccinated? Would you say go traveling, go to Europe, go around, live your life, so to speak?
Yeah, so we are at a point in the pandemic where there is a lot of gray. There's no clear black and white answer. Everything is nuanced. And by the way, we as clinicians are very comfortable with that nuance because when we talk to individual patients, we are giving advice based on that patient's individual circumstance, their values, their medical history, what's important to them. I think the difference is when we're trying to communicate to the public and trying to give general guidance, that nuance sometimes gets lost. And so I would say in this case, there's no right or wrong answer to this question. It really depends on the person. And here's what I mean. Let's say that you are an older individual. You have waited your entire life to travel to Europe. You are recently retired. You wanted to travel last year. You didn't have a chance to. Now you really want to travel. Maybe your child, I'm making this up obviously, but maybe your child and your grandchildren live in Europe and you really want to go see them. Here's the thing, you're fully vaccinated. The chance of you becoming severely ill is very low. you potentially could get ill and have a breakthrough infection, but chances are it's going to be mild. You probably will not end up in the hospital. Chances are you'll have mild flu-like symptoms or maybe even be asymptomatic. I would say, you need to understand the risks that are involved, but also consider the value of that activity to you. If it's something that you really want to do, and you need to weigh that risk versus the benefit. And I think many people looking at that risk-benefit calculation might well say, yes, I want to travel. I want to go. I'm still going to take some precautions. So for example, I'm going to have a very well-fitting N95 mask when I'm at the airport and on the plane. When I go to my destination, I'm going to stay out of bars. But I am going to go to outdoor restaurants. I am going to go to museums that are not super crowded. And I am going to see my family when I'm there. Some people who might want to be careful about young unvaccinated children that they're going to visit might also say, hey, I'm going to take a test once I arrive on the other end as well. And I'm only going to see unvaccinated people outdoors out of an abundance of caution. I mean, those are also choices that people can be making too. But I also think that it would be a reasonable choice for somebody else for example, in the case of my family, we have unvaccinated children. We are not, we've traveled to Europe. My husband lived in London for 13 years. I lived in Europe for a few years. Yes, we would love to go back and visit at some point, but the potential risk to our unvaccinated children outweighs the value of that activity to us at this moment. But I think we would have made a very different choice if we were in our 60s with grandchildren in Europe or the desire to travel. Again, I think, I'm making up some examples here, but I use that because there's so much nuance in the decisions that people make at this point. I would say if people are vaccinated, they are not a threat to themselves or to others. And so they should really make the best choices for themselves as to what risks they're willing to take and what is the value of that activity in their lives.
Thank you for that. That sounds very practical. And I'm sure there's people who are going to hear it who are basically exactly who you're talking about with a variation here or there. But in any case, that's good sort of knowledge to keep in mind while also knowing that, as you said, things can change on a dime with this virus. And who knows, in 2 hours, we may have some news that would make people reconsider lots of things. In any case, that being said, look, this is sort of going to go on for, well, you didn't really answer, which is okay, because you can't, no one can answer, but this is here to stay for the time being, let's just put it in that very vague way. And you are devoting yourself to this. When we get off this call, what are you going to do? What's pressing you right now? What's needling at you?
Well, one of the issues that I've been trying to raise to the public's attention is the one that you and I have just talked about, which is that the dynamics of the pandemic have changed. And it is time for the CDC and the Biden administration to change their strategy as well, and certainly for local jurisdictions to change too. And so I have been working with other public health leaders to press this administration on this. Perhaps by the time the podcast airs, it would have changed. But it is something that I have been actively working on the policy level to get our policies aligned with the realities of what's happening on the ground. Another area that I've been actively working on is on the patient advocacy side, is, if you will, information to the consumer, the news you can use, translating that policy to everyday lives. And so I write a weekly column for the Washington Post on the policy aspect. I also work on a weekly Q&A for CNN.com on what can people take away from it. So given what we know now, should vaccinated people be wearing masks indoors? What about children going back to the school in the fall? What should parents be concerned about? So I've been working on that element of the news you can use. What can people take in their daily lives? And then at the same time, I'm also working on a third component, which is looking forward past COVID, if there is such a thing. But as we emerge from COVID, how do we make sure that we have learned the lessons and are not forgetting about paying attention to health disparities, that we are not just equating public health to infection control, which is a key part, but there's a lot more to public health as well that we also cannot forget, including addressing our overdoses that are escalating again, making sure that we bolster our public health workforce. And so I'm continuing my work at George Washington University and the Brookings Institution to help advance the future of public health, laying out the agenda for public health moving forward as well.
The future of public health rests in large part with the next generation of doctors. Not that you're anywhere near retirement, but there are people.
No,
sorry, don't mean that at all. But there are people. There are people who are maybe in high school now, maybe in college, who are curious about all this. And we all need people to go into your field to have a civic mindedness about public health. That what rising tide raises all ships, so to speak. I think public health is no exception there. We all do better when we're all doing better. So what about mentoring? Do you work with young people? I know you do some teaching, some lecturing. How do you convey your passion to young people? And I know that's difficult. People say to me about, where's the passion for music come from? I say, it has to come from inside, like medicine did with you.
That's right. I mean, I am very fortunate to work with a lot of mentees and students. I chose to be in academia for a reason, because there were mentors who made such a big difference in my life, and I want to give back as well. I have mentees in many different communities, from the Rhodes community to medicine to people who stutter, who I mentor as well. And I feel very strongly about this, about encouraging people to think about the Congressman Elijah Cummings, the pain, passion, and purpose, and also to do what they can now. Sometimes the problems that we face can seem so big, and people often face what I equate to decision paralysis, that especially when we're talking about public health, that there is so much that that is in public health. And public health affects so many other elements. And so I think sometimes people say, well, where do I even begin? But I give them the example from the ER. I may have a patient in front of me who is very ill or has many complex medical problems, but if they are in front of me and need help, I don't say it's somebody else's issue to deal with or somebody else needs to go first. It is my job to address their concerns to the best of my ability and to start somewhere, not letting perfect be the enemy of the good. And if it's anything that we've learned from coronavirus as well, it's the impact that we all must have. That it is a matter of all of us seeing ourselves as part of the public health workforce too.
I love the way you finished the book. You're talking about two of your dearest mentors who died a month apart, Elijah Cummings and Fitzhugh Mullen. And you're talking about how they were champions for social justice and they touched so many people with their work. And you write here, I'm quoting, at Congressman Cummings' service, I recounted what ended up being our last conversation. I knew he was very ill. I told him how blessed I had been to have been under his mentorship. And he said, I'm the one who's blessed because you are part of my destiny as I am part of yours. And then you write, Lena, when those who mentored, taught, and cared for us will forever be part of us, their legacy lives on as we carry the torch to the next generation and fulfill our shared mission to fight for the world as it should be. I think these are such good words to leave a book on, such uplifting, optimistic words. We need aspirations, right? We have to look high. We have to aim high and see how close to it we can get.
That's right. And we should also keep in mind that no matter who we are and what stage of our career or life we're in, there is someone out there looking up to us. It may be a sibling, maybe a cousin, it may be a colleague, it may be somebody who we don't even know. But there's somebody else who's looking to us for inspiration, for mentorship, for guidance. I have been so fortunate to be blessed by so many incredible mentors in my life. I wanted to uplift their stories and also highlight the stories of the incredible people in Baltimore, the incredible people working in nonprofits, in public health agencies all around the country and the world. And I am blessed to be able to work in this field that is saving and changing people's lives every day.
Dr. Lena Wen, for that, we thank you. I thank you personally for being here with me, having such a candid conversation. I hope you'll come back. There's a lot more to talk about. I'm sending you all my best.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.